Welcome to Alternative Dog Moms Podcast. I'm Kimberly Gauthier, the creator of Keep the Tail Wagging. For the past 9 years, I've been blogging about raw feeding, pet wellness, and life as a crazy dog mom. I've seen massive improvements in my dog's health since I started raising my dogs naturally, and I'm passionate about sharing my experience to help other pet parents.
I'm Erin Scott. For the past 9 years, I've been researching and learning everything I can about healing cancer, allergies, autoimmune, and mystery illnesses in both my dogs and myself. And I can't wait to share with you everything I've learned on this journey. As the Alternative Dog Moms, we're bringing you all the latest dog health news that we're following and sharing the tips, tricks, and resources we learn along the way. Now, let's get started. Hello, Kimberly.
Hello, Erin.
So we have Daniel Shuloff back with us today so that we can finish talking about his DCM lawsuit filed on behalf of his company, Keto Pet Naturals. And so, Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks, ladies. It's good to be back. Quick costume change.
So I feel like we still have so much more ground I want to cover, and I'm so excited to dive into this. So we left off last time where you were telling us about like the cherry picking of the data and how this was reported to the FDA and how only the cases of DCM that were associated with any kind of boutique, exotic, grain-free diet were the cases that were being reported. And that contributed to the FDA publicizing this thing saying that there's been a spike in DCM-related cases and we're going to look into this. And then that started like a public panic. And in the lawsuit, you lay out four steps of this conspiracy, this process that happened. And so, yeah, the first part being the cherry picking of the data. The second part is coming up with this term, the BEG diets, the boutique exotic grain free. It's like this nice little acronym, you know, that you see everywhere. And then the third step is mischaracterizing the science, where the defendants repeatedly lie to the public about the evidence of DCM. They make false statements in industry organizations and blogs, and they do this thing called self-citation. And I was like cheering when I saw this described so efficiently. This is where one member of an unlawful enterprise cites to false statements made by another member of the enterprise. So we start seeing these citations everywhere, like, oh, this, you know, organization says it, and this company says it, and this doctor says it, but they're all like collaborating together, right? And so they're all just, you know, pointing to each other. And I was thinking of the pharmaceutical industry and safe and effective, safe and effective.
Yeah. I mean, it's like there are levels to this. Like the idea of self-citation within a group of commonly interested, you know, scientists can take the form of like, I don't know, bad form and kind of unprofessional activity, which is, you know, not great for the professional practice of science, but is also not unlawful. And then it can rise to further levels depending on what kind of facts you have and the nature of the self-citation. So yeah, this is like a phenomenon, self-citation, that's more broad than this, you know, lawsuit, the like conduct described in this lawsuit.
Sure.
But in our case, yeah, it's really egregious because it's like they're highlighting things from other members of this that are involved in this conspiracy as well, that they know the truth about, and they're not highlighting the truth, and they're continuing to perpetrate misleading stuff. They're mischaracterizing the stuff that they're citing. Those types of things are what elevate it from like the more mundane form of self-citation that unfortunately does happen to something more.
And then the fourth step is where there's like the propaganda campaign where it's all over the blogs, it's all over the podcasts, it's all over the Facebook groups, it's giving the vet webinars, you know, it's marketed to the veterinary industry. And, you know, with Hills being the primary corporate defendant in the case, I thought it was such an interesting analogy that you had made in the complaint that, you know, Hills is owned by Colgate-Palmolive Corporation, and that Hills started marketing to vets the way that Colgate markets to dentists. And like, we've all seen that, you know, four out of five dentists. Yeah.
So that's like a, that the development of the strategy of branding Hill's as the number one recommended brand of pet food was, it's not like, you know, they do it the same way, help you understand it by analogy. It's like the company was successful doing it with dentists. And then they were like, we should do this again. And it's like publicly reported prior to my book. I cover the relevant facts in my book, but like the Wall Street Journal ran a piece where they had a guy who was a former executive from Hill's who walked through why they did it and how they made that decision to become that focus, like to make their brand about that. And it's really, to hear him tell it, it's just like, yeah, it worked incredibly well for Colgate. You know, the logic being that it's difficult in a competitive market to try to convince every person that brushes their teeth that you've got uniquely good toothpaste. It's just a logistic, you know, it's not easy to do. You have to be able to communicate with all of them. You have to be persuasive to all of them. But most people go to their dentist and ask their dentist, what do you think? Is that rather than try to figure it out for themselves, they defer to the expertise of somebody that they trust in that domain. And Hill's had that realization, or excuse me, Colgate had that realization. So they said, we're going to just try to market to the dentists. And that's what they did. And they weren't, you know, marketing prescription only products, right? These are things that you can buy over the counter, not unlike Hill's would later do with many of its products. But the idea being that like you didn't have to go to the dentist to have a dentist prescribe their product, but that people do that, that they defer to the expertise of people that have credentials in a domain that they're interested in. And it worked. You know, I have the specific facts in the book. I can't call them to mind right now exactly how financially successful it was, but it was like a huge win for them. And it was an aha moment as they picked up the Hill's Pet Nutrition brand short, like around that same period of time. And said, let's try to do the same thing, and did it incredibly well. They pioneered the idea. Now it's like there are a couple of other brands that to one degree or another use a similar kind of strategy, but Hill's is absolutely the pioneer of it. And they're the leader even today. They were the first. And as a result, in part, they've become the most well-known like veterinarian recommended brand. Can I just add one quick thing, which is that it's super relevant to the lawsuit. Because it, you know, the reason we talk about it in the suit is because the nature of the like DCM scandal relied heavily on that dynamic where Hill's is, by virtue of how it's built its business, able to communicate in a coordinated way with veterinary professionals. So clinical practicing vets and veterinary technicians that work in their offices in a way that most pet food companies can't. And so they could very more effectively than most put out a singular message and get that message out into that discrete community. And because through their, you know, like the whole idea behind marketing to their products to veterinarians is that people really do listen to what their vets to some degree have to say about those kinds of topics. They trust their veterinarian on that stuff. And so people look to their vet for that kind of information. And so by convincing America's veterinary professionals of false stuff about DCM, that was a really effective way to get that message out into the broader lay public.
Yeah, I'm curious about when they went from marketing themselves to veterinarians to then getting the veterinarians to push this narrative because this was pretty impressive how quickly this snowballed completely out of control. And it was one of those where there were people who knew better and who had like an audience, like they had people that would listen to them who were like, yeah, you don't want to touch this topic. I mean, it was just known in the, you know, the blogging sphere. You don't want to touch this topic because they'll come down on you. So it's just, it's, you know, when it comes to Colgate and then marketing to veterinarians, it sort of has a positive spin kind of, whereas
you don't have to highlight bad things about your competitors. You can just highlight good things about your products if you want.
Exactly. And they took this and I just find it interesting because it happened around a time when social media, I mean, social media has had levels of toxicity since its formation. But during that time, it was, you know, so much was going on just in the world. It was so toxic. And it was sort of like people were ripe for a conspiracy theory to latch onto, and they were right there with it. And it's just, it's kind of frightening to me that they got veterinarians, people who we're supposed to trust, just that we're looking at people with these letters behind their names that are associated with universities that are respected. And they, whether, you know, my question is how much, well, at the time, my question was, do they really believe that this is a problem, or are they just lying too?
Oh, so there's, you're highlighting so many interesting things just in that one like little narrative. So let me highlight a few things that like kind of stick out to me. So number one, as far as that transition from marketing to veterinarians using, trying to make the case that your products are healthful, to going to a place where you're going to market your products by lying about other people's, the impact of other people's products, that transition was not as abrupt as just, well, they used to just pitch their products and then one day started DCM. The reality, as we explain in our complaint in the lawsuit, is that DCM was kind of the latest foray, the latest part of a broader campaign. This is not the first time that this company and these same individuals have done use this same kind of structure as part of a campaign. And so the most notable example of it, at least one of the most notable examples of it, is that a period of time before DCM, and I'll get the dates wrong, but I think like the early part of the 2000s, but I might be wrong about that. Go to the complaint if you're hearing this and you have uncertainty and you want it, because it's faithfully reported there.
It's pages 20 to 21.
It became raw diets, right? It became, yeah. It was like the same people, like literally the same veterinary researchers, Lisa Freeman, a defendant in the lawsuit who's played a huge role more than any other veterinarian in the DCM controversy, started writing papers that in one way or another gave the reader the conclusion that you shouldn't feed raw diets for one or another reason. Mm-hmm. And all of them have this kind of at most generous attenuated logic behind them. In reality, I think you could say stronger things about them. But generally speaking, it was like her corporate benefactors saw that there was a group of products that they were competing with that they were not going to ever embrace and start making. And so they leaned on their, the folks who were on their payroll to work this side of the issue into the veterinary community. And so before DCM, I would say this to people all the time that like, I like making bets with people, but like to show my confidence in things. Like I'll say like, go to your veterinarian tomorrow morning. I don't know where you live. I don't know who your vet is. Go to your veterinarian tomorrow morning and tell them you're thinking about starting to feed a raw diet. And I will tell you that I bet you I can predict in substance exactly how your veterinarian will respond. They will say, number one, we don't recommend it.
Yep.
Number two, here's why we don't recommend it. There's no evidence that it's any better for your dog to feed a raw diet as opposed to something else. And there is evidence, and this is due to Lisa Freeman's work, that there's a possibility of foodborne pathogens that could cause concern for, and it's just generalized at that point where it's like, oh, there's dangerous foodborne pathogens. And therefore, there's evidence of cost, no evidence of benefit, therefore you should avoid it. And I felt confident always saying that because it's just ubiquitous. Like they got that belief into the veterinary community so effectively. And as we outline in the complaint, it's part of a very similar playbook to what they would later do with DCM. Mm-hmm. Now, the second thing about the transition from being like a, you know, someone that markets, that uses an innovative approach to describe the benefits of their products, which is to say like marketing to veterinarians, to one that uses bad faith tactics to, you know, demean their competitors. The other thing is that like that stuff with raw diets happened, back in the day, more than a decade ago. In the period leading up to the DCM controversy, Hill's was not in a good place. basically, like, over that period of time, the 2013 to 2018 period, Hill's was hemorrhaging market share. And so we talk about this in the complaint. In the 5 years leading up to the DCM controversy, Hill's grew a grand total of 1%. Which, like, relatively speaking, is like my company is a startup. They grow faster than long established companies do. We're not a spectacular startup. We're doing well, but we're not spectacular. We grow more in 1 month than they did in 5 years. Okay. Like, one, you know, 1% over 5 years. In comparison, the overall US pet food market grew by something like 30%. So Hill's lost a ton of market share in that period of time. And the dynamics that most people attribute that loss to are the rise of, like, basically more education among consumers and the rise in diversity of products that are designed to provide something that's healthier than the Hill's products. So they're struggling over that period of time. And so it motivated them to take a more aggressive version of the playbook, which is like they engage the FDA. And that's what makes the DCM controversy unique. Like, it's part of a broader playbook that they've run before. But what's unique about it is the extent to which they leveraged the FDA's influence to really help, you know, like, it's hard to imagine that the DCM controversy would look like it looks today were it not for the FDA. If they had just, if like the same people had really just worked the scientific record and just tried to put out misleading papers about DCM and grain-free pet foods, it may or may not have been some degree of successful. But like the New York Times ran big articles, Washington Post ran big articles when the FDA announced its investigation. So the FDA investigation was central to like what they did. And that was kind of the most, egregious or just most like breathtaking kind of expansion of the playbook that was engaged in here.
So one of the things that, Daniel, this complaint like really brings receipts where you have all of the emails and attachments and everything. And so Dr. Lisa Freeman, who's one of the defendants, she created a protocol for which DCM cases should be reported to the FDA. And it's on page 40 of the complaint, if anybody's looking. And it says, collect a complete diet history from all patients at every visit. And if the patient is eating any diet besides those made by a well-known reputable company, or if they're eating a boutique exotic or grain-free diet, then report the case to the FDA. So exactly. They like came up with this whole scheme of these are the only cases to report.
And that is an incredibly important aspect of the story here. That protocol that Dr. Freeman created and put to use was produced to me as part of the Freedom of Information Act documents that were sent to me by the FDA. You know, I got 20,000 pages of documents, and this was kind of buried in there. It was like the attachment to an email. And I didn't really understand the significance at first until I started kind of trying to put it into context. But once you do put it into context, you can see that what is taking place by virtue of using that protocol is this cherry picking that that you're describing, where it's like, you're getting a disproportionate share of cases of DCM involving grain-free or BEG diets being reported, whereas other ones are not. And that's very clearly what the point of the protocol is. This is super important because Dr. Freeman knew, as well as anyone in the world, that DCM is a reasonably common disease among dogs. Like in 2010, we highlight this in the complaint as well, Dr. Freeman contributed a piece of writing to something that Purina put together and published. She has a long history of working for like a variety of different traditional pet food brands. And so 2010, before there was a DCM controversy, before there was really grain-free pet food, it was like before Blue Buffalo like made a breakthrough and became a thing, Dr. Freeman put together this chapter in a book that like a reference guide that Purina published that talked about a variety of cardiac conditions. And even she, in that thing, you know, years before grain-free pet food, highlighted that DCM is the second most common cardiac disease experienced by dogs in the United States. Okay. And that she also says in the same thing, one out of every 10 dogs-ish will wind up with a cardiac disease at some point in their life. She's talking about the second most common of something that one in 10 dogs encounter. So you're talking about hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dogs that are going to suffer this disease, regardless of like if there's a connection between grain-free diets or not. You're going to have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dogs. If you want to selectively look for just dogs that are eating grain-free diets within that group, you can find them. It is super easy to just pick those ones out. They're there in multitudes. Like, even if there's no connection between diet and DCM whatsoever, you're going to have hundreds of thousands of dogs a year that are eating BEG diets and are getting DCM. And so if you employ a protocol where you're going to tell the FDA only about those cases where the dogs are eating those kind of diets, you are going to give them a really, really flawed, skewed perspective on how common those diets really are among dogs with that disease. And that's kind of a core part of like the nature of this scheme, is that they did that. And as a result, the FDA was like, in essence, oh, wow, we just got a ton, a huge influx all of a sudden of dogs that seem to have this dietary quality as part of their lives. And that looks scary. But in reality, it's cherry picking. And that's not scary. That's just misleading.
Yeah, I just did a quick Google search for Lisa Freeman, and she was writing about this up until February of 2023, still promoting this narrative.
Yeah, she's played a huge role in it, a huge role. You know, it's like she was a part of communicating directly with the FDA to get the FDA to launch its investigation. She submitted a huge chunk of the cases that they had received prior to launching their investigation. According to the best, like our best ability to like analyze the cases that the FDA received, DCM cases that were reported to it prior to its announcing its investigation, they only received 28 cases. Okay. So it's not like the spike that they referred to, it was the case that they had received over 2017, 2018, more cases of DCM than they had seen in previous years. In previous years, they'd get like 3-5. Something like that. And they got 28 over the, I think, 18-month period leading up to the announcement of the investigation. So they're like, it is more. But what they never told the public, but becomes clear when you look at all the FDA or all the FOIA records that I got, is that 21 of those cases came from Lisa Freeman and another co-conspirator, another defendant, a woman named Darcy Aiden. 75% of the cases in the spike that the FDA saw were from just those two individuals. So Dr. Freeman played a big role there. She played a big role in putting out the academic papers that would later be, she would later and others would later mischaracterize as evidence of an association between BEG diets and DCM. Both like the experimental type papers where she's summarizing some experimental work that she did, but also stuff that's not even experimental papers. The most widely read piece of quasi-academic writing about DCM appeared in the Journal of the American Veterinary Medical Association in 2019, and Dr. Freeman was the lead corresponding author on it. And it's not like we carried out this experiment and here's what we see. It's just a generalized, it's called something, I don't have the title in front of me, DCM, like, what do we know? And it came out at a time when like the FDA had been running its investigation. There's these news articles that are like big deal and are clearly getting read by tons of folks. Veterinarians are getting asked about DCM all the time. And then these five individual vets, all of whom are nutritionists, cardiologists, or both, get together. They've been working with the FDA over the past year, and they're going to write an article that the veterinary community can all look to and go, this is what we know about this subject at this point. But it's rife with false statements. It's like completely, at the time I tried to get the article retracted because it's got so many demonstrably false statements in it. And at first you hear about something like that and it seems like, well, wait a second, how could that be? JAVMA is this very well-respected, very widely read peer-reviewed journal. How is it that these peer reviewers didn't catch all these false statements, but you, Dan, are a guy that did? And the answer, as I asked the editor-in-chief of JAVMA about, and he had to admit later, is that it wasn't ever peer-reviewed. They published this article, DCM, what do we know, and never had it peer-reviewed. They tried to make the argument that it's what they call a commentary which is like when they sometimes in academic journals, you'll get like a news analysis, you know what I mean? Or an opinion piece where it's like, we think this is right versus wrong, which is not something that lends itself to like peer review, because it's not about evidence. It's not about facts. It's about opinion and it's about value judgments, things like that. That's not what this was. This was like a statement about the scientific record, and it's just flat out false. Over and over again, they talk about the association or the potential association between DCM and BAG diets, when in reality, there's no evidence of that. And it was wound up in the most widely read veterinary journal on the planet. And moreover, at least at the last time that I checked, it was by far the most widely read article that the most widely read journal on the planet had ever published. Okay. Oh, wow. So this is arguably the most influential veterinary science article ever written, not peer reviewed, full of misstatements. And Lisa Freeman was the corresponding author. So, you know, I could stay on this all day and talk about her role in it, but she played a very significant role.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we're the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
So I have a note that the individual veterinary defendants in the complaint have authored a total of 15 journal articles, like in that 5-year period, about DCM with all these different false and misleading statements. So it's like this flood of, you know, journal articles that are going out there to keep perpetuating the DCM BEG connection.
Yeah, it works in a million ways, right? It's like anytime a new article like that gets published, you have an opportunity for headlines and news, and Lisa Freeman can write a blog post about the new findings if she wants. It's a grist for the self-citation mill, right? Like anytime you put out something new, then the rest of the folks that are involved in the coordinated plan can refer to it when they're writing their own stuff. It provides this sort of like critical mass. Like there's an aspect to this that's like, you're left wondering, like America's vets don't come out looking great from the DCM controversy. You know what I mean? Like at the end of the day, there's false information that not only did tons of these folks pass on to pet owners, but they did it really confidently and really dismissively when people raised, in many cases, when people raised complaints about it. And you have to like, there's only so many explanations for something like that. And it doesn't really, to my eyes, like pass. It's clearly not the case that America's vets are just all bad. They're all bad people and they're all deliberately trying to mislead the public. That's obviously not what's going on. That's not the nature of it. But it's also sort of hard to like say like, wait, they all just missed this issue that should be clear if you're exhibiting like professional level scientific literacy. And part of why that happened, in my judgment, is that you got this critical mass of paper. There's so much smoke that it's like, how can there not be fire here? We got 15 different papers. Clearly, there's something going on here. And I think that, you know, this like rush to put out, you know, folks like Lisa Freeman effectively devoted their careers to the study of this one topic for this period of time. They were doing like that made up a huge chunk of their professional lives, was just studying this non-existent phenomenon. And so, you know, one of the reasons that, and it's not, this doesn't like absolve veterinary professionals of sort of self-reflection here. In my judgment, like this ought to be an opportunity for America's veterinary population to go like, whoa, 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 how did this happen? What can we do differently to make sure this doesn't happen again? But part of the reason that it did happen is like, this was a well carried out scheme with like a lot of volume behind it. These folks were able to really lean into putting out more and more stuff for a period of time. So yeah.
Oh, yeah. And what's interesting too is with the use of social media, creating a group where you got everyone riled up, anyone who did speak up in with any type of doubt as to what's going on, they were flooded with angry comments. And yeah, so, right. And not only that, it's like we live in a time where you don't have to, like, for you, for your business, if I don't have to buy your product to leave nasty comments because I've decided that you've said something that I don't like. And so now I'm going to rile up my base to leave a bunch of negative reviews and nasty comments when people ask for, because I did that many times where people would make these really outlandish statements. And I would ask, do you have support for that? Because I would really like to read more on that. And it's either, how dare you question me? Why would I lie? Or they would, you know, like the articles you mentioned, you'd get a ton of comments linking to all these articles, which these people didn't read, but it's a quick Google search. And because mm-hmm. it's written by a veterinarian and there's so many of them, clearly there's something going on. Why would she lie?
Right. Yeah. Yep. So the use of private Facebook groups is a meaningful part of the misconduct alleged in the lawsuit. There is, you know, one specific group that's changed names a few times over the years that's particularly notable on this subject. And it played a big role, in essence. There's, you know, misinformation, corporate-funded misinformation in the era in which we live is such a thing. It's so common yes. across industries that there are now academics whose careers are spent studying it. You know what I mean? Like, they're misinformation experts. And a couple of them that are particularly notable are these two professors who work at UC Irvine. And they write about like kind of philosophy of science and scientific misinformation. And they put out this book in 2021 called The Misinformation Age. Kaylin O'Connor is the woman who like I've corresponded with about it. She's one of the two co-authors. And it talks about the latest, as of that point, this is a fast-moving domain. But like at that point, kind of what are some of the most common and most important to understand ways that scientific misinformation finds its way into scientific communities. And they talk about the use of Facebook groups, private Facebook groups, and other like folks who are academics in this domain talk about it too. And they've had a huge role. Those kinds of groups have had a particularly outsized role because unlike social media content that's created in publicly accessible platforms, the moderators of those groups end up having a great degree of control over what comments are allowed, what stuff mm-hmm. you can delete comments. Like it's not just that you make a point that's contrary to the prevailing narrative in a group and you get shouted down. It's also the case that your comments can get just removed. And so as we highlight in the complaint, that's was a really common occurrence amongst folks who have the kind of credentials that we don't have, the folks who are not just veterinarians, veterinary nutritionists, you can find the names in the complaint, but it's like you have absurd situations where people who are some of the most knowledgeable people on the planet about these subjects are getting comments deleted from those kinds of groups because they question the prevailing narrative that they're trying to put forth in there. At the same time, there's this other interesting dynamic about these groups, though, which is that like DCM is a real disease and it's a really bad disease. And when your dog gets it, usually there's a very shitty, pardon my French, but like a really sad outcome at the end of that. Like dogs die of this disease. And the fact that there's misconduct underpinning this and an attempt to kind of blame things that aren't true doesn't make any of that any less sad. And so you're somebody whose dog has DCM, okay? One of the hundreds of thousands or millions of people in the United States who go through that, you go looking for support. You're trying to get better understanding about this. You find Facebook groups like that and mm-hmm. you go there and it's kind of a safe space for you. There are lies going like in there, but it's still performing an important function for you. It's making you feel some degree of like common cause and empathy and like you know, reassurance around this really difficult situation. And so like I've gotten comments from those kind of people and folks who are understanding were like, I get it that like this guy's not, you know, I'm not trying to say that it doesn't, that those people do need a place to get real kind of like community support for that difficult situation. And it's just a shame that the only opportunity for that is this gross made up corporate funded thing. You know, it's like, I'm not trying to take that away from people. And it's sometimes these issues are nuanced in that way, where you have something that is performing a legitimate role, but also a very illegitimate one. And parsing the two things is hard. So it's, you know, it's like, these are not simple issues sometimes. And so I, you know, just to be clear, if you're listening to this show and you're like, well, even if everything this guy is saying is true, it still sucks that I can't go to this group now that I had been going to because I don't trust anything they're saying. It's like, I empathize. That does suck. And I wish that there was a better situation where that was like, there was just good faith, supportive resources available at the same kind of way that these like gross ones are.
I mean, it's sad because they basically took a group and twisted it for their own use. Because as a, you know, as a content creator myself, there is some type of, you know, it feels good to have someone who's very smart, who's very intelligent, who has this great track record. So like a, you know, a Dr. Lisa Freeman, join your group and then start in contacting you and talking to you and stuff. You get kind of a contact high from that because it's like, you know, this person is being so nice and you develop this relationship. And it's, I feel like just in the world that, where people look up to and idolize, you know, celebrities and stuff. If someone says something negative about Lisa Freeman, then they're saying something negative about me too.
Yeah,
and,
I get it.
And I feel like they counted on that and use that, you know, to further this cause. And it's unfortunate because even now, like even after our first recording, I answered two questions about DCM. Like someone said, and I forgot what it was, but because I use a base mix when I make my dog's food, and someone mentioned an ingredient, and they're like, but that ingredient causes DCM. And it's just like, well, no, it doesn't. People don't know that the FDA later came out and said they couldn't find a connection. And now
the FDA didn't run any article, or excuse me, the New York Times didn't run a similarly big article about that.
Nope. And the only reason why we knew it is from people who follow the FDA, like Susan Thixton. And, you know, were it not for this lawsuit, would the FDA had been forthcoming about the fact of why they found no connection and all the stuff that you've discovered and that you're bringing to light, would all of that just gone away?
Yeah. Counterfactual, hard to say, but yeah, it's sort of, this is the process of deconstructing a false narrative that's been constructed by folks who can spend a lot of time and other resources building it up, is that there are a lot of disparate forces that have to kind of work diligently in their various like little domains of expertise. You know, for me, it's like, I do know about the civil litigation system. I'm able to help lawyers who do this kind of work understand the significance of some of this stuff and leverage some of those kind of tools. For someone like Susan Thixton, who's so knowledgeable about like consumer advocacy stuff, she's got her part to play in it as well. And so it's like, it's hard to marshal the necessary resources to compete realistically against something as deep pocketed as like Colgate-Palmolive, unless you have a lot of disparate folks doing what they can in their own kind of way. And it's like, you know, you touched on a second ago, this like, you know, how this dynamic where if you're a veterinarian, you've been like, the idea of going against a prevailing narrative is really hard. It's uniquely hard in professional domains. Like if 9 out of 10 of your veterinary colleagues all are saying the same thing about a scientific issue, you run a ton of career risk questioning that. It's so much easier to defer to the like acceptable sources of information transmission to go like, well, you know, look, everybody else is saying it this way and it's based on these things that are facially valid. I'm just going to go with it. There's not a lot of risk in that. There's a ton of risk if you question that. If you go, well, Dan and Aaron and Kimberly said this on their podcast, and so I'm going to disregard the JAVMA article, and you're wrong. You end up, that's career risk, man. That's like career suicide if you do it too overtly. And so you can see how there's these like, and that's a part, that's something else that these folks from Irvine have written about. It's a natural dynamic that's part of these professional communities that leads to this kind of like bubble of false information, that how it can happen. Like, despite the fact that veterinarians are generally scientifically literate people, how did this happen? That's part of the explanation, is that like, there is an insufficient incentive to question the truth about certain kinds of topics. And I think it's kind of what was at play here. Seems like.
And it sounds like once Hills became aware that this lawsuit was going to happen, you were even seeing some negative things on your company's social media too.
Yeah, we did. I don't know. We haven't gotten to the discovery phase of the case yet. And so we haven't had the opportunity to depose people, anything like that. However, shortly before the case was filed, after they knew that the case was coming, somebody affiliated with a competitor, somebody else who makes pet food, coming on to one of our web properties and saying anything negative about us. And we've been around since 2018. I don't think it's ever happened once. But days after Hills became aware of this, we just happened to get a nasty comment referencing litigation on our Facebook page from somebody who's a Hills employee. This woman came onto the site and basically said something false, frankly. It was like, oh, your diets have so much protein. I hope you're ready to get sued by all the pet owners that, because protein is bad for dogs for some BS reason that had no real grounding. Hope you're ready to get sued by all the pet owners, something like that. And so, yeah, I don't at this point know if that's just a pure coincidence or not. But yep, we did. That's the they have the notable distinction of being the only competitor that's ever come to our website and made some nasty comment on it.
And you also mentioned in the complaint how, you know, you had customers canceling their subscription to your product or not wanting to take, you know, not wanting to feed their dog their product because their vet was saying, oh, that's dangerous. You know, you can't do grain free.
That's not a past tense. That is something that happens still. Like, it's a testament to what Kimberly was mentioning a minute ago, where it's like, these issues have really long staying power, and that like, even after the factual predicates that gave rise to them go away, they're still in there and they still take time to filter through the public's knowledge. And yeah, to this day, I get customer service tickets. And as I've been going around talking to folks on podcasts like this one, there's one particular type of ticket that I get that is particularly blood boiling. It's like you try to, I don't know, I like to think that I'm not overgeneralizing about how or being too harsh on folks who got misled, veterinary professionals who got misled as part of this and were trying to do good things, but ended up not, you know, teaching people bad information. But there is a variety, a flavor of that, that I have a lot of trouble kind of finding my way to that sort of like emotional place on, which is lots of dogs and lots of cats get diabetes. Diabetes, as you guys probably both know, is essentially a disease where you're allergic to carbohydrate. Like, you can't process the natural byproduct of eating carbohydrates, glucose. Your body can't process glucose well. You don't make enough insulin to process glucose. And so one good way to help somebody, a dog, cat, or human being with diabetes, is to feed it less carbohydrate. But Hills Pet Nutrition makes the most popular prescription-only formula for dogs with diabetes in the country, and it's 40% digestible carbohydrate. So dogs tend to have really bad process when they get recommended that food. They end up having to use tons of exogenous insulin in order to bring their glucose numbers back under control. Our products are only 5% carbohydrate. So when diabetics make the switch from a product like that to ours, they inevitably have lower blood glucose and they inevitably need less insulin, which are just like excellent outcomes if your dog has diabetes and makes pet owners very happy. I get tickets like to this day from customers who go, my dog has diabetes. I used to feed it this other diet. I switched to yours because I saw one of your ads. It's been phenomenal. I use a third of the insulin I ever had to use. The dog's blood sugar is much better regulated. It's a total godsend for us. However, we were at the vet the other day and they told me that I shouldn't feed your product anymore because of DCM related concerns. And so it's like in those instances, you have medical professionals going, this disease that your dog has that you're managing really successfully because you found a product that works well for you, that shouldn't be your big concern. Your big concern should be this disease that your dog does not have that I'm so confident in my knowledge about that you should abandon this thing that is working well for the dog. That is like, given that how simple the like etiology of diabetes kind of is and how obvious it should be to anyone with a medical degree that the first thing you ought to do for an animal that has diabetes is remove the carbohydrate from its diet. That paired with the fact that you're elevating this other disease above the disease that the animal has is just like inexcusable to me. And I swear to God, I get them all the time. I get them regularly. And it's just like, it is very hard to generate understanding and empathy in regards to that. Cause it's just like you're harming those people. Mm-hmm. You're harming those dogs. Like that is what's going on there. You're telling an animal with the disease, don't treat it because you should be worried about this magic, fake, made up fairy dust thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one other thing that you mentioned just about how this whole thing has impacted different companies, that there's like a chain of pet stores, like the independent pet stores that, you know, were selling a lot of these grain-free diets that ended up declaring bankruptcy.
Yep.
Because of, you know, all of this DCM connection, and that was one of the factors anyway that was contributing to like this whole company going bankrupt.
It was the number one factor, and they filed in their bankruptcy petition. So yeah, it's IPPE. The broader point is like, if you buy pet food from a brick and mortar location, you kind of go to one of three different types of places, generally speaking. You get it from the vet directly, you get it from a big box type place like Petco, PetSmart, or grocery store, or you get it from what are called independent pet specialty retailers. And that's everything from the mom and pop single location to a chain that's not a big box, but is still sort of framed up as we carry the healthier for your dog stuff. We don't carry the mass marketed products. We you know, curate the products that we carry to make sure that everything is holistic and healthy and what have you. And it just turns out that maps really nicely onto the term BEG diet, that like essentially what those guys carry are BEG products. At best, it's a disproportionate share of their product line, but in many cases, it's the entire product line. That like, if you buy the notion that a BEG diet is going to give your dog DCM, you should not buy any product from a lot of those stores because they're all BEG. So it's a horrible thing for those pet specialty retailers. And it happened right at the same time as the COVID pandemic, right? So you have these like brick and mortar shopping is facing a strong like incentive. It's like a negative. It's a difficulty for them at the exact same time. And so that 1-2 punch was kind of too much for a lot of stores. And IPPE is just kind of the best example. You know, when you file for bankruptcy protection in the United States, you have to tell the court why you went bankrupt. And IPPE highlights the reasons. And the DCM controversy was a bigger thing for them than COVID was for them. That's how serious it was. And it was one of the biggest chains of pet specialty in the country, went from being thriving to going bankrupt as a result of it. And so if you're listening to this and you don't run IPPE, but you might run an individual pet store, there are, you should, if you reach out to Aaron and Kim, they can put you in touch with me and I can put you in touch with our lawyers because they are investigating putting together a second class that's based, a suit based on the damage that's been caused to the pet specialty retailers. Because it's a really discreet group that's like been hammered just as badly by this as the individual brands that have gotten defamed. So yeah, I suspect we'll see that quite soon. That's like a serious thing that's coming along.
So I was just checking the docket for the lawsuit this morning, and I see that there's now, I guess, an extension until June for Hills to respond and presumably file some sort of motion to dismiss or, you know, otherwise quash the complaint. And so it sounds like we won't have any real movement happening in the next couple months.
Yep, that's probably right. Yep, exactly. They reached out and they said, you know, we'd like an extension for presumably, like you said, they're going to, how much of this is legalese and how much is like something the audience would like. The one of the first steps of a lawsuit is like you kind of have, in some way of speaking, is you have three different times where the two part, like the parties involved in the suit are going to fight. The first, I mean, you fight throughout, but like there are three times, three different like venues. The first is before any evidence has been formally gathered by the two sides. It's like I file my lawsuit, putting together the stuff that I've put together on my own. The other side then has a chance based on that to go, even if you accept all that is true, they still lose. You know what I mean? Like if you say, oh, you know, Aaron is liable to me for the wrongful death of my heir. You might say, well, that person's still alive. So like, I can't be liable for wrongful death if that person's still alive. As you've, the allegations you've said don't give rise to liability, even if we accept them all as true. And that's essentially what will happen now is Hills and the other defendants will in all likelihood try to make the case that the court should throw out the suit, even if you accept everything is true. The court doesn't do that. Then, as Aaron knows, we go into the evidence gathering process. You go through what's called discovery, which is when you get to depose the other side. You get to gather all the documents. And then once all that is done, which is a long, as you can imagine, in a case like this, where there are so many people and so many documents involved, it takes a long time. Then you get a second chance where the parties try to go, look, there's based on the evidence, there's no actual factual dispute here. We both agree that they published the article on this date, and therefore the case should be resolved based on that lack of a dispute. And if then there's any case left over, then you go to a trial and you have a jury figure out, based on the conflicting evidence, which version of the truth is more likely. And those are the kind of the three different times. Like you're saying, Aaron, we're at a point where we haven't even seen Hills's like attempt to get the case dismissed yet. It will not get filed until at least June. We'll then be able, it'll be a fight over briefing. We'll respond to it and try to explain why the arguments don't hold water, don't make sense. And then the court will have a period of time to rule on it. And these are going to be big pieces of writing that the court won't just rule like from the hip on. It's going to take time. And so, yeah, you're talking about months in the most optimistic timeline, potentially not 2024. It's entirely likely that you wouldn't get a ruling on this until 2025. I'm happy. I'm getting married in May. And I was at first, we had a deadline that was like right before the wedding. And I was just like, oh my God, it's going to ruin my personal experience of the wedding because you get this like, you know, you get the arguments that are like, Dan's case, your case should go away based on, and it's very hard to let that go, for me at least. And so I'm grateful that it's at least a little later, but yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much you can say about it. Like, do you expect any other parties to join your side of the lawsuit?
What can I say about that? So our case is just about BEG brands. So there is this like separate category of folks who have been damaged by the same misconduct, at least one other group, which is these pet specialty retailers. There's arguably other groups as well. I feel reasonably confident that we'll see pet specialty classes coming forward soon or being filed soon. I'm not sure I feel like I have a good sense of whether anything else. As far as other brands that also make BEG pet foods, at this point, they really don't have any incentive to come out one way or the other. Like they can, if we win at this motion to dismiss stage, that's very good for them. In class action litigation, the way it works is like you get an opportunity to opt out for, like, I define a class. I say to the court, like, we want to represent all BEG pet food companies. I don't have to get sign off at this point from every BEG pet food company in order to do that. But what does happen later is if the court says, yeah, you're right, you do get to represent all them, they all get a chance to opt out. You can say like, no, I'll litigate this on my own. And in a case where the other members of the class are like big like this, like when it's an individual, when it's sometimes class action involves like, you know, AT&T or a wire, I won't say them specifically, but like a wireless company uses something in their contract that's unlawful. They're going to fine all bald people an extra $30, right? And all the bald people in the country get, one bald guy comes out and says, you know, that's unlawful. They should have to pay $5 million to the 1 million bald people who are all clients. You don't opt out of that because your personal stake is $5, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's no reason for you. You don't have the financial incentive to litigate it on your own. In this case, the other members of the class are big. They're corporations. Some of them are big. And they might have an incentive to opt out of the class and pursue it on their own if we get far enough. But at this point, they want to just see what we can do. Really, I would be my guess. I've had some conversations, but like generally that's what I expect, is that they're watching it closely. And if we have the kind of success that I'm hopeful and expectant to have, then we'll encounter that later on. Folks will either decide to let us litigate the case for them, or they'll say, we're going to do this on our own. We want out. But at this point, it's like, they got nothing to kind of lose by virtue. They don't have to even say I endorse Dan's perspective at this point. They can just be quiet and sit there and let the judicial process work.
Yeah. So you're the canary in the coal mine on this.
Yeah. I mean, I get to take the heat for them. Like, it's not that, you know? And so there's that. You know, it's like different brands have responded to the DCM controversy in all sorts of different ways. You know, some have been more aggressive about pushing back on it and taking steps that help to uncover, you know, facts that are counter to the more prevailing narrative. Some have leaned into putting out science that they think helps to paint a more accurate picture of DCM. Some have just said, change the product line. Like, we'll just try to modify our product line in a way that absolves us of this concern, you know? And so not everybody has dealt with it the same way. Reasonable minds can disagree on it. That kind of stuff will impact who's willing to like keep going and who isn't.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for your time today and explaining all this to us. You know, we're definitely going to be watching closely, and I hope we'll get to talk to you again on the other side of things.
or further down the road might be the way to say it, right?
Yeah, like there will
be noteworthy stuff about this litigation throughout as it goes. And so as that happens, we'll have an opportunity to talk more, I'm sure.
I will be watching.
It's good news, you know, right? We'll see.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Take care, guys.